With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. The governor signs one insurance bill, but bigger fixes are needed. Some farmers and other property owners who have had to turn to the California FAIR Plan, the state's insurer of last resorts, may soon have better coverage options thanks to a new law. Governor Gavin Newsom signed legislation to improve commercial property insurance options for people who have struggled to access coverage due to the impact of wildfires. Farmers suffered a double blow to fires, losing crops and farm properties, as well as the ability to insure their properties and commercial assets as insurance companies denied policy renewals. They say more legislative fixes are needed. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report. And now let's get into today's show headlines. McAuliffe to visit the Oakland port. The U.S. Chief Agricultural Negotiator Doug McAuliffe visited the Port of Oakland yesterday to tour its facilities and engage with stakeholders. McAuliffe was joined by local international longshore and warehouse union leadership and local members of the Pacific Maritime Association. Ensuring the success of America's farmers and producers has been a top-line priority for the U.S. Trade Representative's office under Ambassador Catherine Tai's leadership. The trip follows a recent labor agreement between West Coast port workers and the International Longshore and Warehouse Union and the Pacific Maritime Association. Most recently, USTR secured an agreement with India on September 8th to resolve the last World Trade Organization dispute and lower tariffs on certain U.S. agricultural products. This built upon the agreement finalized with India in June, which terminated six other WTO disputes and removed retaliatory tariffs on other U.S. agricultural products. NAFB contributed to that report. And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more agriculture news.
Mating disruptions become more prevalent in addressing naval orangeworm issues in orchards. Entomology and Pest Management Advisor with UC Cooperative Extension in Kern County, David Havlin, described how the practice has been benefiting growers.
Mating disruptions, sort of a new innovative technology that for a while was something that growers experimented with and got a feel for. But now several mating disruption products are very well developed, have become mainstream, and are actually becoming the standard way to manage certain pests. So the naval orangeworm products very much have become mainstream for both almond and pistachio growers. Most of the research has been done in almonds. In that case, there's four different companies that have mating disruption products that are either aerosols or meso emitters. And those products all consistently show about a 50% reduction in damage, which is pretty good and totally comparable to one or more insecticide applications. So that's good. From an economic standpoint, they're reasonably priced. So if a grower has typically 1% damage, we'd call that a break-even point. Very common for growers to have that level. In fact, that's sort of a statewide average or maybe even under the statewide average for damage. So, you know, if you look at it that way, it not only makes sense for widespread use, but literally half or more growers, if they use it, will actually make money, more money than what it costs to implement it. So price points are a very good location, and that's one of the reasons we're seeing so much adoption.
Full proposals for projects aimed at addressing methane emissions are currently being accepted by the California Department of Food and Agriculture. The new 2023 Livestock Enteric Methane Emission Reduction Research Program is part of California Climate Investments, which uses cap-and-trade funds to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. The California Budget Act of 2022 allocates $9.5 million to support demonstration trials involving additives and other dietary modifications, which have the potential to address methane emissions from livestock. The Reduction Research Program will award competitive grants to universities with or without a private partnership, nonprofit research organizations, and California Native American tribes. Applicants who've advanced from a pre-proposal phase are being invited to submit full proposals by 5 p.m. on November 1st. More information about the program is available at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
October 12th is National Farmers Day, a time dedicated to those who wake before the sun rises and often work until long after it sets. Thanks to farmers' tireless efforts, we have the food, feed, fiber, and fuel we need here in America and plenty more for export. Best of all, farmers produce all of this sustainably, so that future generations can have the same bounty. Today and every day, please join Syngenta in honoring the men and women of American agriculture.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, U.S. Senator John Cornyn of Texas voiced his thoughts on the budget delay on the House floor Wednesday.
Mr. President, by my watch, today is September the 20th. The fiscal year for the United States Senate and for the United States government ends in 10 days. Congress, which is required to fund the government by passing appropriations bills, has not passed a single appropriation bill 10 days before the end of the fiscal year. So the obvious point is that unless Congress acts to fund the government in the next 10 days, the government will be without funds and large portions of the federal government will shut down. Now, notwithstanding the fact that some people think maybe that's a good idea, we're spending too much money here, so let's just shut it down. Well, tell that to members of the United States military and their families. Tell that to the men and women who serve bravely as members of the Border Patrol, Customs and Border Protection, that are responsible for processing the goods that enter into our country as from our trading partners that create millions of jobs. Tell that to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. Tell them that they will have to work and not get paid.
He said shutting down the government is not a solution.
Well, as may be obvious from my statements, Mr. President, I'm not a fan of government shutdowns. I've noticed from my experience that when that happens, the same problems that caused you to shut down the government are still there staring you in the face when the government reopens. And it creates a lot of collateral damage and a lot of collateral expense. It doesn't actually save money. It actually costs more money because of the disruption. And shutdowns harm innocent people and create needless uncertainty for our economy.
The senator put pressure on the Senate.
I know here in the Senate we're always looking for leverage to try to persuade people to do what we want or to vote for the things we like or to vote against the things we don't like. That's leverage is part of our the way we operate. Shutting down the government does not provide leverage, certainly not to the people who ultimately are for the people who ultimately contribute to that shutdown. But sadly, that seems to be the direction we're heading in. And it's been pretty clear for a long time now that the Senate Majority Leader, the only person who can actually bring bills to the floor and schedule them for a vote, that he's trying to play the old Washington blame game. It's not my fault, it's somebody else's fault. In this case, he wants to put the blame solely on the shoulders of the House of Representatives and Republicans who have a thin majority there. Before the August recess even ended, Senator Schumer began pointing the finger at House Republicans, referring to their desire to secure spending cuts. The horror.
No action has been taken this week on the Farm Bill, which expires next week. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's Livestock Report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, some of the cattle industry wonder if the current trends of shrinking cattle supplies and higher prices will continue into next year. Well, Gary Crawford has a story looking at that and how hog producers could see better prices next year.
Last year, the U.S. produced almost 28.5 billion pounds of beef. The forecast for this year?
Just under 27 billion pounds.
USDA's Outlook Chairman Mark Chekanowski says the current declines in cattle numbers and beef production are expected to continue into next year, with production down again in 2024, down to about 25 billion pounds, a drop of around 6.5% from this year.
So supplies tightening up,
pushing steer prices up. For this year, USDA forecasting an average price 178.5 per hundredweight.
And for 2024, that's expected to increase by about $7 per hundredweight to $185.50.
According to USDA data for last year, hog prices averaged over $71 a hundredweight. This year, that price is more likely to average only around $59. However,
we do expect that to increase next year.
This, even though pork production's not likely to be much different than this year. So what is motivating Chekanowski into projecting a price rise next year?
Several factors, including continued strength in demand, as well as, you know, tighter supplies of beef that should also support pork demand and ultimately hog prices,
which he says could average $64.75 a hundredweight next year. No, it's not up to last year's $71, but it's a lot better than this year's $59. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Thanks, Gary. And Mark Chekanowski, USDA's Outlook Board Chairman, also has the 2024 projected forecast for broiler production and prices.
Broilers, we're looking at year over year an increase in supplies, production up 620 million pounds to 47.3 billion pounds year over year. Prices for 2024, given those higher supplies, we're forecasting slightly lower prices. Broiler price is right now at $1.21 per pound, and that compares to 2023 price forecast that we have at $1.23 per pound. So year over year, down just under 2 cents per pound.
Again, that was USDA Outlook Board Chairman Mark Chekanowski. And American Farm Bureau Federation economist Danny Munch presented testimony this week during the ongoing federal milk marketing order pricing formula hearing. This is the third time an AFBF representative has testified at the hearing. The testimony focuses on adjusting make allowances or the estimated costs that dairy processors incur to convert milk to consumable dairy products like cheese and butter. This price directly impacts the price paid to farmers for their milk. AFBF is advocating for make allowances to be adjusted based on a USDA survey, which AFBF is pursuing legislation that would direct USDA to conduct such a survey. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
GMOs? Genetically engineered? Bioengineered? What's what? Well, GMO stands for genetically modified organism. It's the common term many people use for foods created through a process scientists call genetic engineering. And you'll start seeing bioengineered on some food packages to let you know the product or some of its ingredients come from GMOs. Feed your mind with more GMO knowledge on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
How the U.S. uses most of its apples. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. There are a lot of ways to eat them. Pies, cobblers, crisps, with peanut butter or cheese, or made into sauce or cider. However, new data from USDA's Economic Research Service shows a majority of apples are used in juices. In 2021, nearly 46 pounds of apples per person were available for domestic consumption. 52% of the available apples for U.S. domestic use, or nearly 24 pounds per person, was in the form of juice or cider, or about 2 gallons per person. Fresh apples accounted for 34%, or nearly 16 pounds per person. Canned, frozen, dried, and other forms made up the remaining 14% of apple availability in 2021. Over the last 10 years, per-person apple availability reached a high of nearly 50 pounds per person in 2016. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. Boundary issues are not uncommon in rural settings. What if a survey doesn't match an existing fence line? What controls? How is the actual legal property boundary determined? Landowners generally consider existing fences to be the boundary between adjacent properties. But the law may view things differently. The actual boundary is an imaginary line that can be found by examining the deeds to the adjacent properties. An existing fence line is merely evidence of where the boundary line between the properties is located. It is immaterial whether the fence is a permanent fence or not. However, there may be situations where the fence line has become part of the property description over time as the land changed hands. In that situation, the fence line may be considered to be the legal property boundary. But if a parcel is described by mapping out survey lines, an existing fence may not be on the surveyed boundary. Instead, the adjacent owners may have treated that old fence as the boundary. In that situation, the old fence can be substituted for the actual legal boundary under the doctrine of practical location. Once that fence has been used as the boundary for a set period of time defined by state law, it can become the legal boundary by filing a court action to quiet title. In the ag setting, it's often the case that boundaries are determined by usage rather than by survey. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
The publication arm of the American Farm Bureau Foundation for Agriculture's latest book offers a detailed look at how potatoes are planted, grown, and harvested. Illustrator Chloe Burgett says the book from Feeding Minds Press, Potatoes for Pirate Pearl, explores a potato farm.
It's an amazing story of a pirate that runs ashore on a potato farm. And you get to explore the potato farm with Pirate Pearl, and the farmer shows you around and all the different aspects of growing potatoes.
Burgett visited a potato farm to draw inspiration for illustrating the book.
Feeding Minds Press sent me to a potato farm in Utah, and I met this farmer named Tyson. It was a really inspiring trip. He showed me around his family's farm that had been in his family for 6 generations, and I dressed as Pirate Pearl so I could explore his farm as a pirate. The farmer is named Farmer Faye, and she shows Pirate Pearl around her farm. And I designed her as an older woman because it was really about her handing down this generation knowledge of farming.
She says books like Potatoes for Pirate Pearl offer an important look at where food comes from.
There's a scene in the book where Pirate Pearl and Farmer Faye are figuring out all the different ways they can cook potatoes. And I think learning where those potatoes came from and how they got to the kitchen is something really special. And it's something that you don't just think about when you're reading a book at story time, but you would think about in your own kitchen when you're getting out your ingredients and you wonder, like, where did this stuff come from? So I think it's a special connection point that children and just people can make every day.
Learn more and order the book at feedingmindspress.com. Michael Clements, Washington.
Efforts continue to advance innovation and natural resources conservation.
Our conservation innovation program, it really helps us with looking at how do we move to the next generation of farming. We're taking applications through October 30th.
USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service Chief Terry Cosby says CIG funding is broken down into 2 categories.
The classic is most of the ones where we work with partners to look at new technology and how do we develop new tools. And we always talk about this next generation of conservation efforts. And then we get into the on-farm trials, and that's where we work with producers and look at more adoption. And then we also look at evaluation of these conservation approaches. And all that's doing is helping us build new technology, look at new techniques, new approaches.
The funding distribution for this latest round of grant awards includes
about $65 million that's available. There's $15 million available for the classic, and that's the one that we do with partners. And then there's $50 million for the on-farm trial, which is more with producers on-farm.
And with every conservation innovation grant application cycle, both categories focus on specific funding priorities as determined on an annual basis. For CIG Classic, funding priorities include
more of the traditional stuff like forestry, habitat conservation, managing agricultural lands to improve water quality, energy conservation. We want to look at the economics of doing some of these things. And we also want to help with our indigenous knowledge when we're working with tribes and indigenous people across this country.
While priorities for on-farm trial funding focuses on
irrigation water management techniques, nutrient management, feed management, grazing lands, and then we're really interested in soil health demo trials.
More information about the Conservation Innovation Grant Program is available through local NRCS offices or online at www.nrcs.usda.gov. CIG funding applications and information about the application process are available through www.grants.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Trade volume continues light as we end the week in the grain and livestock trade, but looks to pick up some momentum the week ahead. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report brought to you by Kloss Equipment and Helmina. Helmina says next growing season starts right now with soil-enhancing humic compounds this fall like Resurge. Visit HelminaAgra.com to learn more. Well, we end the month and end the third quarter the week ahead. Daily trade volume has been light, and it looks to remain so early week. Few buyers wanting to step in, maybe some sellers taking some profits. As one observer said, everyone who wants to be long in this market, livestock or grain, is already long. We would see December corn holding recent lows near 465, 467 the week ahead. November soybeans hard-pressed to hold $13, but think they will. Kansas City December wheat finding buyers below 718, 720 in our view. This is the bottom line report. Refuel your farm equipment for free. Register to win $10,000 worth of free farm diesel from Kloss. Go to fuel.kloss.com. We mentioned yesterday, we see the on-feed number today very similar to September numbers the past 3 years, near 11 million head. If cattle supplies are tight, it hasn't shown up yet in these monthly reports. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day and a profitable week ahead.
The House Farm Bill fight is looking a lot like the Senate fight. A House Farm Bill appears hung up over the same fight as in the Senate, food stamps versus food production, a fight made worse in a no-new-money Farm Bill year. Ag Senator Chuck Grassley revealed to farm reporters this week that internal Farm Bill talks are hung up in a fight pitting food stamp spending against boosting crop reference prices. Over in the House, Ag Chair G.T. Thompson told an Axios forum meeting producer needs will be his priority for a new Farm Bill.
The difficulties that those families that provide our food are facing. So that's the inflationary costs, the Russia-Ukraine-Belarus situation, which has decreased our access to some of our imported fertilizer you need to increase productivity. And with increased productivity, you can feed more people. So it's the inputs.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
Corporations are among climate smart commodity partners. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack recognizes the role of corporations among many groups of partners within USDA's Partnership for Climate Smart Commodities program. Here's USDA's Rod Bain with comments from the Secretary in this next report.
Large companies as partners in domestic and global climate-smart commodity production. Some may question if this could happen as efforts to develop climate-smart markets take place. Yet Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack, speaking at a World Food Day event Wednesday, noted,
"We are partnering with those very companies right now. And the Partnership for Climate-Smart Agriculture and Forestry Commodities, there are major food companies that are part of this effort. And there are also major retailers that are part of this effort."
Among the several company names recognized that are participating in such projects, beverage manufacturers such as Coca-Cola and Pepsi, food production companies like Cargill and Hershey, and retailers such as Target. And Secretary Vilsack acknowledges,
"There's a subset of consumers that want it, and they ought to have it. And by having that market signal together with what the government's doing, you can send a pretty powerful incentive."
USDA's Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities Initiative recently recognized the one-year anniversary of its initial round of funded projects. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Yes, 50 years ago, the idea of farmers markets and producing food for those markets and for a few local consumers was what we would have called a groovy idea. One of those quaint so-called feel-good ideas. But today, according to Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack,
"This is not some feel-good activity. This is an economic engine and driver.
And it's an engine that's, well, picking up speed. Yes, sounds like it. Local food sales amounted to very small potatoes, so to speak, 20 years ago, with farmers markets being really the main place where farmers sold direct to consumers. Today, a different ballgame.
During the course of the pandemic, we realized and appreciated that we needed to transform our food system, that as efficient as it was not as resilient as it needed to be. We knew that it was going to be important and necessary for us to build a stronger, better, and better supported local and regional food system."
And the Agriculture Secretary gave reporters the other day a long list of things that have been done to boost the development of local and regional food systems.
"We've increased money and investment in local agricultural marketing efforts and farmers markets. We expanded support for local and regional meat and poultry processing with a loan guarantee for mid-level supply chain, warehousing, cold storage operations. We look forward to announcing additional support for meat and poultry processing for new and expanded plant construction. We've also announced a non-meat and poultry processing assistance program."
Vilsack said having more local food production, local processing, local marketing will not just make the national food system stronger, but also on the local level,
create more new and better markets for our producers that would increase profitability and more choice for consumers.
Consumers who more and more are wanting to buy more and more locally produced foods, and for good reasons.
"Things like tomatoes are much better if you pick them and eat them fresh rather than picked early and shipped.
Definitely the flavor is just so much better because it's like fresh."
Fresh, yes. This is Fresh. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. For today's interview segment, we have part three of my conversation with San Joaquin County Farm Bureau's Executive Director, Andrew Genasi. Together, we've been chatting all about the California water rights systems. Today, we're discussing how water rights bills that have been introduced in the past and some that are soon to be crafted impact the California agriculture industry and the state's economy as a whole. So let's go ahead and jump into a few significant bills that have popped up over the last, year, maybe 2 years. I mean, I know water bills have been here, there, and everywhere. But
these particular ones are associated with the water rights system, and they could change up the way things happen. These three bills are Assembly Bill 460, Assembly Bill 1337, and Senate Bill 389. Now, some of these are gone now or are in the works still. Some of them are pressing forward. So if you could give me a brief summary of each of them and where they stand now.
Okay. So SB 13 or 389 is the only one still standing. That bill has been significantly changed and amended to the point where most agriculture and water groups that were opposed to it are now neutral. All it says now is that the State Water Board can investigate senior water rights, which is something that it wasn't expressly listed in that the early water legislation, that they have the right to look at the validity of the amount of water you're claiming under your pre-1914 senior water rights. So this would allow the state board to investigate to make sure that, yes, you do have a valid claim, and yes, you're using the correct amount of water. And like I said, these things have been watched over. There's a lot of paperwork. The people who have these senior water rights are very confident that they have that they're good. So if the State Water Board wants to look at it, fine. Go ahead and look at it.
Yeah.
The other two, the AB 460 and 1337, both those bills really had to do with those senior water rights. What it would allow the board to do, and forgive me, I don't remember which one was which right now, but together the two bills would allow not only for the State Water Board to look at your pre-1914 rights and give them a greater amount of control over those. It would allow them to curtail water rights, even if there isn't a water emergency. Right now, like if there's a drought emergency, they are able to go through, and those post-1914 rights, they can start curtailing, saying, you know what, everybody's taking a 25% haircut or 30% haircut. You know, we're cutting people back. In an emergency, they're able to do that. This would allow them to do that without an emergency. They could just declare, hey, you know what? Everybody's water right is going to lose 30%. It's shrinking by 30%. We're going to balance it all out and make it quote unquote fair. So that is the idea there. It also would not allow you to challenge it in court. It would take the court system completely out of it. You would work through the State Water Board. And when they made their decision, they'd be judge, jury, and executioner, and you had to deal with it. So I think they were a little upset a year or two ago. They had challenged some pre-1914 rights and tried to curtail it, and the court stepped in and said, nope, according to legislation, you do not have right to control those pre-1914s. So this was kind of an end run around that, to change the legislation and give them the rights to curtail those water rights, even in a non-drought, non-emergency time, and give you no chance to challenge that. So,
well, now that doesn't seem fair at all.
Yeah, right? So it really, I mean, our water rights have been looked at every time you have a drought, right? People start looking at it and go, oh man, you know, we've got to do stuff for
point fingers.
Different communities. We got to, you know, ag's using too much, or, you know, municipals using too much. It's always somebody, the people at the short end of the stick, the people at the end of the line for water start looking for a way to get water. And it's just been in this last decade or so that really the water rights are starting to be questioned. And the validity of the California system, there's challenges not only legislatively, we have environmental groups who are suing the EPA on the management of the Delta, saying the water rights system is inherently racist and was established for the benefit of one racial group over others, and people of minority groups were not allowed to get water rights until the mid 1900s. And their hope is to basically get rid of the water rights system we have now and basically reapportion, which sounds easy until you start thinking about land values, businesses, you know, because that's, as we see now with Sigma, if you have ground with access to surface water, it is worth multiple times what the wide area, so-called wide areas, the areas you do not have access to surface water. That ground's worth a lot more if you have water. If you have a reliable supply of water, like with the senior water rights, the MIDs and TIDs in our area, OID, Oakdale Irrigation District, South San Joaquin Irrigation District, some of those groups with very high water rights and a reliable source of water, that ground is worth even more than people who are just happen to be in an irrigation district, right? Maybe further south, it's dealing on the state or federal system that doesn't have, you know, they're getting the, you know, 50% allocation, 5% allocation, like you never really know. So if you go ahead and you strip those water rights, all of a sudden land that banks have loaned money on, land that you've used as, you know, assets when acquiring and expanding or are using as a year-to-year asset to secure rotating funds or loans to fund your operation. If you pull that water out, you throw land values across California really into disarray. And you think 2008 was bad. Just watch what happens with land values throughout California. If all of a sudden nobody knows who's going to have water next year. This would be devastating. And not just for agriculture, for the economy of California, because anybody who pays attention knows that California really is the bottom of the pyramid when it comes to the California economy, especially here in the Valley. You know, there's so many jobs not only tied directly to the farm, it's hauling, it's processing, it's marketing, it's, you know, buying and selling and trading and everything that's tied to that. You rip the bottom out and the whole pyramid comes down. And I don't think that these groups understand what they're potentially going to do to California with this. And so you see bills like this year, we had these three bills that really were looking at changing the whole dynamic on how water is done in California. And we could say that 460 and 1337 are dead, but really they're a 2-year bill. So they'll be back next year. The language will change. I'm sure there'll be tweaks, but, you know, doing what they can to help get, you know, the chances of passing that, they're going to change that language, but they will be back. And this is just the next front on this war that, realistically, I think won't ever go away. There are groups who feel that larger and larger percentages need to be going to environment, that larger percentages need to be going to municipalities, and agriculture is the easy target because there's not that many of us.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. The Ag Innovation Challenge Top 10 Teams. 10 teams have been chosen for American Farm Bureau's Ag Innovation Challenge. The challenge gives startup companies more opportunities to advance their innovations within the ag industry with funding provided by Farm Bureau and Farm Credit. American Farm Bureau President Zippy Duvall says, quote, "The future of American agriculture is bright, due in part to startup companies like those competing in the Ag Innovation Challenge. Entrepreneurs' innovative solutions to challenges that we're facing today help clear hurdles for farmers and ranchers of tomorrow as they provide food, fiber, and renewable fuel for families both here at home and around the globe." Among the 10 semifinalists competing for the $50,000 grand prize is California-based company UAV IQ Precision Agriculture. It's biological control by drone. The company releases beneficial insects and mites via drone exactly where and when they are needed in order to mitigate pests. The top 10 teams will participate in pitch training and mentorship prior to competing at AFBF's convention. In addition, those teams will have opportunities to network with industry leaders and venture capital representatives from USDA's Rural Business Investment Program. If you'd like to learn more, visit fb.org.
The National Council of Agricultural Employers has opened registration for the 10th Annual Ag Labor Forum. Each year, the event brings together key leaders in the agricultural employment and labor communities from across the U.S. and around the world. This year's forum will be taking place at the M Resort in Las Vegas, November 29 through December 1st. Attorneys, academics, agents, as well as representatives from federal agencies and foreign governments will highlight some of the biggest labor issues facing U.S. agricultural employers. Some of the topics include how employers can protect themselves in the face of union activity, hot topics in ag labor safety, tax issues relative to ag employment, and many others. Also featured this year are concurrent sessions highlighting the H-2A Temporary Ag Visa Program. More information about the forum is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for Agnet West Radio Network.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit Agnet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at Agnet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the Agnet News Hour from Agnet West. Agnet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.